Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Good Sunday morning. It is not Rick Moore. It's Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Good to see you all here, and good to see my guest, Steve Rosenfield. Steve, we've been friends for a few years.
A good number, yes.
Thank you for agreeing to come in. I want to talk about you're a lawyer. I want to talk about a little bit of your background, your life in the law, and then why we've seen your name pop up in the news a couple of times recently. Some cases, high profile cases here in Charlottesville that you've been involved with, and then sort of end with a discussion about why it's so important to have a good lawyer at your side, should you ever become involved with the law or find yourself in front of a judge or in the court. So thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks, John.
Your personal story, if you don't mind me getting a little personal for a minute.
No, that's fine.
Your personal story has always intrigued me because you became a lawyer in an unusual way. You did not go to law school. How did that happen?
When I knew that I wanted to be a lawyer, I looked into law schools, never applied anywhere, but I was working at the Offender Aid and Restoration Program as a VISTA volunteer, and when I interviewed somebody who wanted to be a volunteer, mm-hmm. I asked what their profession was.
Let's talk about VISTA. Some people may not remember what VISTA is.
Sure. VISTA stands for Volunteers in Service to America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the domestic counterpart of the Peace Corps. So John Kennedy came up with this idea. He had Sergeant Shriver take command, and they established both a foreign service and a domestic service. So I graduated with a degree in engineering in 1970, and it was a bad year for engineers. I couldn't even get interviews. People didn't even know I barely graduated, but I never even could get to the interview stage.
And where was this? Where were you, Steve?
I'm born and raised in Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the University of Miami down in Florida. For a year or so, I just could not. I had some engineering interviews, some second interviews, but I never could land a job. And during that time, for the first time in my life, I wondered why in the late 60s there were so many riots and demonstrations, especially by people of color, because I had bought into America being fruitful for everybody.
Yeah.
I thought Johnson's war in Vietnam must have been the right thing or he wouldn't have us there. So the first book I read was Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver,
mm-hmm.
and I got a black person's perspective about growing up in America. And from there, the snowball started rolling when I read Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Ho Chi Minh. I just couldn't get enough of counter views of the traditional way that we think of growing up in America.
So for people who weren't there, maybe some of our listeners who are too young, you know, they sort of hear about that history, and because it is now history. But having been there too, as a younger person, but having been there too, it was really kind of a period of opening our eyes. You know, America after World War II, we were sort of the righteous nation. We were on top of everything, and that period in the late 60s and early 70s is when we started to understand, I don't know, our own failings as a nation.
I grew up too thinking America could do no wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way I was brought up, and it took some initiative to try to see the other side of it.
So you were working. You were working with VISTA. Was this in Florida?
No. So when VISTA accepted me, they assigned me to a place called Cumberland, Virginia. That's an hour south of here. It's a pretty nondescript. People around here don't know about us having pretty much a neighboring county, not that, touching us. But and so I went down and I lived with black people. I being white, this was the first time I had ever had any contact with black people. And it was an eye-opener. I saw poverty that I had never been exposed to before.
Even in Pittsburgh?
Pittsburgh has plenty of poverty. It's a very ethnically divided city. And then you have ghetto areas. But I grew up in a white, privileged Jewish area and had no exposure.
So VISTA accepted you, and you came to Cumberland.
So I worked a year in Cumberland, in large part trying to find poor people adequate housing. Poor people didn't have indoor plumbing, and some didn't even have electricity to go with that. But the Farmers Home Administration was outreaching to poor people. Problem was that little money was provided, and there really wasn't outreach occurring. So some of what I did was finding poor people, getting them to the Farmers Home Administration, and having them apply for homes. The other interesting area that changed my life was not just being exposed to poor people, but there was no money to hire people to build homes for the people who were accepted for loans. There wasn't sufficient money, and so I helped build homes for the same people for whom we were getting application.
So even if they got a loan approved, there was nobody there to do the work.
That's right.
And in Cumberland, you talked about meeting African American families, meeting black people for the first time, but in Cumberland, everybody's poor.
It ranked, as I recall at the time, somewhere around the 27th poorest county in the nation. And along with it was Buckingham County, another top 30 poorest.
So did you grow up in a socially conscious family? Was there much talk of these kind of issues with your parents? Or was it the times and the events of that period that kind of drew you to wanting to work with the underprivileged?
I grew up in a middle-class household, there was not much political talk. But both of my parents were very generous. Mm-hmm. They gave not just money, but they gave of themselves in helping poor people, both black and white. And I'm sure my brother and I both picked up on that. Although it wasn't talked about, or we weren't given lectures about helping the poor. It was just something that we observed. And I think that obviously helped shape me for later life.
So it's now still early 70s, mid-1970s?
So 1971, I got a letter from VISTA saying that I'd been accepted. I went for training in Philadelphia, a week's training, and then they made the assignments. And the other three people with whom I was training had a look up on the map where Cumberland, Virginia was. So after a year down here, you normally serve just 1 year in VISTA, but I learned about the program in Charlottesville that was just getting started called the Offender Aid and Restoration Program, the J. Worrell began. And that really had an appeal to me because now my politics were very far left. And I saw an amazing group of people who were even worse off than poor people being imprisoned for such lengthy periods of time.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about the Offender Aid Program.
Offender Aid and Restoration was designed to match up people in the community with people in our local jail with the idea that they would simply have a friend. The volunteer would go and meet with their offender, and the offender might say, you know, I haven't been able to reach my mother in a week. Would you mind calling her? I could sure use a book about trees. They don't have it here at the library. Mm. So the volunteer had access to their offender. It was a very progressive program that the jail permitted and fostered. It's still operating today. Pat Smith has been doing it for about 30 years. And I came to become friends with many of the people in the local jail who would go on to prison. So my relationship with them continued and allowed me to learn more about the state prison system as opposed to the local jail system.
My guest is Steve Rosenfield. We're talking about law and working with the imprisoned and working with the poor here in Virginia. So I didn't realize, Steve, that you had been here all that time. So you've been here in the Charlottesville area since the
71. 1970s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, 35 years. 45 years.
Yes.
I'm terrible at math.
No, that's but you have it right.
And then so somewhere in there, now Virginia, you got your, you became a lawyer because I think you told me once Virginia is one of the few states that allows you to
we call get it, that. We call it reading law.
Reading law. Yeah, tell me about that.
There are only three states, California, Mississippi, and Virginia, that mm-hmm. permit one to apprentice the law and then be eligible to take the bar exam, just like all the other law school graduates.
And that's still true now.
And that's still true now. Virginia's program is a minimum of 36 months, and most of my apprenticeship was at the legal aid office here in Charlottesville. At legal aid, we only practiced civil law. And as a law student studying there, I was exposed. I had some limited exposure. So I took audited courses at the law school. So when I say I didn't go to law school, I really mean I didn't graduate or was accepted there. I never applied, but
right.
I attended. I took six courses in the six semesters during the 3 years of my apprenticeship at Legal Aid.
Wow. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and we're talking to a reliable progressive, Steve Rosenfield. So you were auditing courses at the UVA Law School for 36 months, and then you took the bar.
I did. I took that and passed it the first time.
Passed it the first time. I mean, there are people who go to law school who don't pass it the first time.
You know, much of it is luck. I took the bar review courses that teach you how to take the bar exams, mm-hmm. and that was immensely helpful. And so, so much of my life, I feel, has been pretty lucky. That was among them. I had nightmares for about 8 years that they realized that they had made a mistake in grading my exam and that I was going to have to turn in my license.
You're going to knock on the door.
No, that's right.
A couple of big shoulder guys in suits say, give us that certificate back.
That was my fear. There were two efforts to have me disciplined or disbarred, and those were dismissed by the Virginia State Bar. But
and when was that? Was that early on?
Early in medium on in my I finished reading law in December of 76. Took the February bar, and in April learned that I was now a licensed attorney. I was still at legal aid, mm-hmm. and I practiced a year as a VISTA lawyer. So the VISTA program was paying me. I was assigned to the Community Action Agency who assigned me to legal aid. Then after a year of being a VISTA volunteer lawyer, legal aid, Peter McIntosh, the director, found the money, and I was hired as a staff lawyer.
So wait a minute. Does this mean that you were operating for a year without a salary?
No. I was paid $52 a week as a Vista lawyer.
Okay, all right. So you were raking it in.
Yeah, that's right. You underestimated my income.
I think even in 1976,
It was still a modest wage.
Yes.
So the places I lived at, three out of the first five places I've lived at would later be condemned. So they were modest, to say the least.
So basically, you left, and they said, "Oh no, no one can live there."
Well, yes. While I was there, one of them was condemned, but they allowed me to live out my lease.
So it's the mid 70s. You're getting by on $52 a week. You're living in condemned buildings. You're working for legal aid. So when I look back on my 20s. They've kind of achieved sort of this golden haze. Do you look back on those years with some sense of romance?
Not being tied down to anything. I could afford to live on $52 a week. I may have even saved a few bucks. I was on food stamps, so that subsidy was necessary and helpful. But it was, I put in easily 60, 70 hours a week work at legal aid, as did most of the attorneys, even staff attorneys, because the demand was just so great. But, we all flourished.
Yeah.
It was, like you say, it was a romantic period because we were our own people. We were always up against the system. So it was a an enlightening period, but for sure it was one that I look back on fondly.
Well, it was also a time of great transition in this country, culturally and historically. So, in many ways, it sounds like you were sort of living out, being a part of kind of a cultural revolution that was starting in this country as we were looking. Tell me about some of, is there a case that stands out or types of cases that stand out, sort of things that you were working on at the time for legal aid?
It was not while at legal aid. We had so much work. It was fairly routine work that we were doing. I never really got a chance to put my teeth into systemic changing cases that would have great import on our community or the larger community of our state. It wasn't until I went into private practice. So I practiced as a lawyer for 2 years at Legal Aid from 77 to 79. And I went out on my own because I wanted to practice criminal law. I thought politically that it was important to get the kinds of representation to people charged with crimes that they weren't getting. As when I was a volunteer at OAR, I saw firsthand how poor the court-appointed system was, how corner-cutting, incompetent lawyers were taking on representing people charged with serious crimes and even not serious crimes, but doing very little work. And I saw that as a layperson. I would go to trials. I would get to know the defendants who would always complain about their lawyers. And there were a few lawyers back then who were conscientious, and you were lucky if you could get them as a court-appointed lawyer. But the overwhelming number were pretty incompetent and uncaring. And I thought that that's what I would like to do, and that's why I left legal aid and started my own practice doing a lot of criminal work.
It is about 20 minutes after the hour. This is Sean McCord on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Welcome back to 94.7 WPVC in the wake-up call with my guest, Stephen Rosenfield. This is Sean McCord, subbing for Rick Moore. So we're up to about 1979, 1980. And you've started your own private practice. Was that here in town, here in Charlottesville?
Yes, I've always remained here.
Were you working out of a condemned building?
Well, no, it was a building that I would later buy, but it's funny you ask, because to get into the front door, you had to step up, but there were no steps. And so I got a couple of rocks, and my first several interviews with clients who I got refer to from Legal Aid. Uh-huh. I met them at the Random Row restaurant that used to exist.
Oh, Random Row, still miss it.
Isn't it the truth? And they were friends of mine, and I was thankful they didn't charge me rent for holding my interviews at the restaurant. And people didn't seem to mind that they were meeting their lawyer at a restaurant to be interviewed.
So, but you said you later went on to buy this building?
Yes. Years later, the landlord said, I'd like to sell it, and gave me the first offer. I took out a bank loan and purchased it along with another colleague of mine.
Mm-hmm. So where's the building now?
So it's at 917 East Jefferson. Mm-hmm. I was there for about 20 years. And then I sold my interest to my partners, and I would later buy the building next door at 913 East Jefferson, where I have been for 20 years or so.
Yeah, we'll get to that break in a minute, but I want to sort of paint a picture for us of what it was like to be a young criminal lawyer, and that means a defense lawyer, and you're working with a lot of people who I assume didn't think they could afford a lawyer. So you're getting references from Legal Aid. Were you being assigned cases by the court?
I was being assigned cases by the court. And earlier you asked me if there was some, very early on, if there was a big case that I had
right.
taken on. As I worked closely with poor people in the community, I came to know the people who were called the town drunks. They would be found asleep in the bushes, and the police would take them to the jail. And I became friendly with many of them. At some point, the prosecutor at the time began bringing civil cases against these individuals under an old statute called interdictment.
Civil cases.
Civil cases, and what they were asking the judge to do was to declare that somebody was an abuser of alcohol and was no longer allowed to possess alcohol. The prosecutor brought these cases, and the first one I remember was Preston Fisher, somebody who was thought to be a town drunk, a great, great man.
Mm-hmm.
And I challenged the statute, and this was probably my first big case. So as both a civil rights lawyer and a criminal defense lawyer, I undertook to challenge the statute, but also to represent him later when he would be, of course, found with alcohol.
Yeah.
He was an alcoholic and charged with possessing alcohol after being directed not to. I represented him in a jury trial. And so I let it be known to the prosecutor that every time he brought one of these, there was going to be a jury trial. And we have not had another case brought since 1980 or 81 when I challenged this. And I lost in federal court, went up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, but it was my first foray into serious civil rights litigation. And here I was, you know, relatively new attorney, 3-4 years after license.
So this law, you said it hasn't been enforced, but is still on the books as far as you know.
It is, and Legal Aid is now challenging it again. And I think maybe with better resources and better lawyering, they may be able to have this statute struck down. But there still has not been a prosecution that I'm aware of for people who have been interdicted.
So you went from $52 a week as a Vista volunteer to I
made $12,000 as a staff lawyer at Legal Aid from 78 to 79, and I went out on my own, and I made about $8,000 that next year.
That first year.
So I was accustomed to...
I was going to say, you sort of gotten used to...
It was not... And I had no family here,
yeah.
So it was something that was affordable. People who had families would not have been able to take on the kinds of cases that I took on.
You'd spend many nights sleeping on the couch in your office?
I always made sure I had a couch at my office. that's only changed recently, but I've had couches in my office forever for just that reason.
So somewhere in there, and put me on the timeline, put it on the timeline for me, you became involved with Virginians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
Yes.
Was there a particular case or a series of cases, a client that you had to defend that brought you to that group?
Virginia reinstated the death penalty after it had been found unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in about 78 or 79.
Right.
And the first execution was in about 80 or 81. Although I was doing criminal work, there were very few of these cases brought around the state. For some period of time, and then it started to become a huge wave of trying to get capital convictions and seeing that people are executed. In Virginia, at one time, we had about 80-some people on death row. We were second only to Texas in the number of people that we were executing. We were at the forefront in Virginia. And somebody had started, it was all volunteers back then, an organization here in Charlottesville opposing the death penalty.
I
became the lawyer for that organization and would continue to be a part of that organization as a lawyer, as a board member, as president of it, later going on to represent people who were condemned to die, appointed at the habeas stage. I never had anybody at the trial level be given a death sentence, and I feel very lucky, and I had 9 of those. But I deeply oppose the death penalty and wanted to do whatever I could as either a practitioner or as part of an organization.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I've been talking to you as a lawyer. Let's take off your lawyer hat for a minute and just talk about as a citizen of this state. When the death penalty was reinstated, you said Virginia kind of rushed to, almost like they were in competition with Texas, to execute more people. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think the death penalty is all about politics.
Mm-hmm.
It is back then, Republicans and Democratic prosecutors alike were seeking death. We know statistically that they sought it against people who killed white people. Whether you be white or black, you were 4.3 times more likely to get a death sentence if your victim was white, because we gave a higher premium to the value of a white person. Statistics showed as time went on that black people were charged more frequently with capital punishment, especially when the victim was white. So the system has always been politically rigged to enhance politicians' fervor for feeding Virginia's biases against black people and in favor of the value of white lives.
Well, I agree with that. You hear about prosecutors, especially if they're running for public office, have to show that, you know, they're tough on crime. And yet, Virginia is a little bit of an outlier. I mean, some of our surrounding states, I think Maryland, for example, has no death penalty.
That's correct.
Yeah. So it's
West Virginia.
So you've been in this state for we've established over 40 years.
That's correct.
Do you think there's something going on here? Is there some vestige of the plantation South?
The subject is a complex one,
yeah.
And easily could take an hour or 2 hour program. Let me give you the beginning and the end. The beginning I've talked about of prosecutors rushing to prosecute and to kill people. And where we are now is that we have a 44-bed pod called Death Row, and there are only six occupants. So we have 38 empty beds, and there are no prisoners in the pipeline. That is, we haven't had a death sentence issued since 2011.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it's been that long.
Almost all of the people now for whom death is sought by Democratic prosecutors, not by Republican or independent prosecutors in Republican districts. It's a phenomenon to me how this has played out over the years. Now, this is also, you can see this across the country, the decline of prosecutors seeking death. We have defense lawyers now who are specially trained in Virginia. We have a special unit that the state has funded, the Capital Defenders Unit, and they do nothing but represent people charged with capital crimes and for whom death is sought.
And you said this is funded by the state.
It is. It's part of the public defender system. So there are many combinations of factors in why we have very few people on death row. And when and if any of these people get executed, we're going to end up funding death row for years to come because Democratic prosecutors want, not Republicans. Now, the Republicans dominate the legislature,
right,
but their own party has no taste for seeking death. And when death is sought, it's rarely given by jurors. And so that's another complicating message to the state who has to pay for all of this and to prosecutors. Well, why spend all those resources if you're down in Grundy County? Why put in those kind of resources when statistically you're unlikely to get a death sentence?
Right, because there's simply an economic argument against capital cases, because you had to put so many more resources into it because, you know, obviously the stakes are very high. And you said that you said that juries seldom...
That is now the trend. And I don't pretend to know why DNA finding people who are to be executed are now exonerated is a factor. I think jurors have seen the CSI programs and
right.
wonder why the evidence isn't stronger.
Sure.
You have better qualified defense lawyers. More resources now are being given because in the old days, defense lawyers were not given investigators. They weren't given access to specialists who could help tell the jury about the psychological problems that may have led this individual to have killed in the way they did. So it has changed the landscape of America, and Virginia is really not only no different than the rest of America, but we are seeing a trend in Virginia that may be unparalleled in other states. More and more states are doing away with their capital system for many of the reasons that I've just mentioned.
This is 94.7 WPVC, Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCoy talking with Steve Rosenfeld, and we've been talking about capital cases and the death penalty. Let's spend just a few more minutes on that before moving on. Certainly the Innocence Project, which is a nationwide effort, I think has brought a lot of attention to these kinds of cases, and people are realizing that you can be convicted with poor evidence, I don't want to go out on a limb and say corrupt prosecutors. Let's just say prosecutors.
Overly zealous
prosecutors, right. With a system that seems to be designed to find people guilty
That's right.
No matter what. And then there's the, tell me the technical name for this, Steve, where, because I have served on juries before, where if you're in a capital case and you're against the death penalty, then you're dismissed from the jury. So you've already instead of having a sort of a representative sampling of the community, of a jury of your peers, you've got people on the jury who have already said that they're perfectly okay with the death penalty.
We call it death qualification.
Thank you. That's
what you were trying to think of. And you're right. It's the U.S. Supreme Court said that people who are intractably opposed to the death penalty may not sit because of their bias. Only people who could give a death sentence are allowed to sit.
Okay. So I get that. If you're intractably opposed to it, that makes sense to me. But then that what you end up with is what you call the death qualified juries, where people are like, yeah, okay, you know, I just I'm kind of comfortable with this.
That's right. I think comfortable, and I think some people do struggle. Statistically, in Virginia, about 1 in 10 juries in capital cases are giving death. And I told you that we haven't had one since 2011.
Yeah.
And that was somebody who wanted to be executed. He was a what we call volunteer. He had killed so that he could get a death sentence and was later executed somewhere around 2012. You know, many of us feel that's a pretty imperfect system, that you find jurors who are eager, some are hesitant, but they're all capable of giving allowing one of their fellow citizens to be executed.
So you've been working with this issue for a while, and you've talked about a change. Do you know that demographics in this country are more people still? I know the numbers have been changing. The numbers have been going down.
Yeah.
You know, if a majority of people still support the death penalty in period or in theory, or have those numbers?
It's still a majority of Americans surveyed, but when those same individuals are asked, do you think that life without parole is a good substitute, the majority of Americans think that's okay.
Yeah.
So, and that's in Virginia, the jurors have to be told that there is no parole for people who might get convicted of capital murder.
So this is a pre-recorded show, so we're not taking calls. But what would be your response to someone who calls in and says, hey, look, if you killed somebody, then you don't deserve to live?
You know, we all have our own moral compasses, mm-hmm. and there are others who feel that the state has no business to be killing people.
Right.
All of us, really, no matter what your age is, who is listening to this program, knows about the state's act of killing when the Nazis were in charge. And there are many, many other states around the world who execute their citizens, and we are aghast at the reasons why they do it. And yet all of Europe, who has no death penalty, are aghast at American states that still execute people.
Well, before we go on our break, I just want to go on record as saying I think this is one of our national embarrassments, and then in a generation or two, people will look back on this period, look back on states executing prisoners in the same kind of horror that we look back on slavery. It is about 40 minutes after the hour. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. It is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord talking with Steve Rosenfeld. We got a little passionate there, but this is, I think, an important topic. So when did the Supreme Court temporarily get rid of capital punishment?
That was in 1972, the Furman decision
Emptied
the death rows across the country. They all went into general population, and many of those were released.
They were later released
on parole.
So then, was there a wave of homicides following that?
No, in fact,
what happened to these people?
This major study that tracked down almost all of these individuals found that those who remained in prison were the least likely to commit crimes within prison. Now, you know, that's a statistic that still holds true today for individuals who are given life without parole. They are the least inclined to commit crimes within prison. For those who left death row and were released to society under the Furman decision, the study showed that they committed crimes at a lower rate than citizens were committing.
Wow. So I don't even know how to address it. So at least in that narrow sense, the system works. You commit a crime, you go to jail, you get released back into the general population, the jail, or you get released out, and okay, these aren't necessarily, you know, sterling examples of citizens.
Sean, but you know that 90% of all Virginia prisoners will be released back into society.
Mm-hmm.
Notwithstanding that we have no parole, they'll do their time and they'll be back on the streets. And we do nothing for them while they're in prison. But still, those who don't recidivate, you know, or become regular citizens.
And what do we do with them after prison? What kind of programs do we have here in Virginia?
Well, the system's so totally broken. It's when the sociologists look back, as you say, years later and say, for such a smart technological society, how could they not figure out that trying to help prisoners while they're in prison is a way to avoid them committing crimes when they reach the streets? It's surprising that we don't have more crime from people returning to the streets, but we do because we do nothing for them.
And this has been the work of your life. I mean, this has been the work that you've been doing since you became a lawyer in the late 70s. These are the people you've worked with, and you've come to know many of them as people. You call them friends.
I represent of the six people on death row, I represent four of them in a conditions lawsuit of which we will be hearing a decision by the federal judge in Alexandria any day now, where we said the conditions on death row were cruel and unusual punishment. And preliminarily, she has already concluded that, and we're waiting to see if she'll grant an injunction preventing any effort by the state to reverse.
Has this happened in other states where they've found the conditions on death row to be unconstitutional? And what has been the result?
There are other state decisions that have found too much segregation or isolated housing is cruel and unusual punishment. And the conditions on death rows have not been challenged like we did in Virginia, but California has found that death row was unconstitutional. And here in Virginia, once we brought the lawsuit and got a preliminary ruling from the judge, the state spent $2.6 million to set up apparatus for six inmates. Now, if that makes any sense to anybody, especially the Republicans out there listening, I would like to hear what the rationale is for keeping a capital system and a death row in Virginia.
My guest is Steve Rosenfield on 94.7 WPVC, the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. People might have seen your name recently because you've been associated with a couple of high-profile cases. In fact, you were here at WPVC on Andre Hicks' show several weeks ago, a couple months ago, I guess, talking about Robert Davis, and you were here with Robert Davis.
Yes.
Remind us who Robert Davis is.
Robert Davis was arrested at age 18 for a double murder. I was one of the two lawyers.
It was right here in Crozet.
In Crozet.
Yeah.
A mother who was brutally stabbed and killed, and her son who, by mistake, was asphyxiated by the fire brought on by the burghers.
A woman was stabbed, and then the house was set on fire.
That's correct.
So there were two clear homicides here.
Yes.
And Robert Davis kind of got swept up by the police.
He did. The two kids who lived across the street would each implicate themselves, but they also implicated Robert because they thought it might deflect the harm that they had caused.
So during the interrogation, the police said, look, we know it wasn't just you. Who else was involved?
Yes, that's right.
And they both independently picked this kid, Robert, who was another neighbor.
Ten doors down from the killers, somebody who they didn't even like.
Right. I mean, like he had gotten into a fight in school.
He had been beaten up regularly by the boy who confessed to the murder.
Right. So they thought, well, let's just throw this kid under the bus.
So we had him. I was his appointed attorney along with somebody else.
So you were appointed by the court?
By the court. I talked Robert into pleading guilty to a crime I know he didn't commit. And the reason was we had a co-defendant who was going to testify against him and a confession that I thought was coerced. Robert took a plea agreement and received 23 years for that double murder.
People have read about this, and he spoke about this at length on Andrea's show, but there's still, you hear this, and you kind of sit up and take notice. Even though you were convinced that he didn't have anything to do with this, you told him to plead guilty so he could accept a plea, because otherwise
The risk was too great. And you see this from time to time, that people could get life sentences if they don't take the deal offered by the prosecutor.
Now, was this an Alford plea?
So under Alford versus North Carolina, people could plead guilty even though they would not admit to their guilt but believe the evidence was enough to convict them.
Right. There was enough evidence that they felt they could be convicted, so they plead guilty for those reasons.
That's right.
And so he was sentenced to 23 years.
And over that course, over the course of 12 years, the two murderers finally came forward and said under oath, for the first time under oath, that Robert wasn't involved. And the confession was evaluated by the leading academics in the country, experts from around the world. Many, many people looked at the videotape interrogation, and they concluded that it was unreliable because of the failure of the detective.
Right. So the confession was recorded. In fact, this was, I heard Andrea play a section of this. It's apparently on YouTube.
Yes.
You can go on and look it up. And at that point, I mean, he was, how old was he?
He was 18, 18? Chronologically, but 14 emotionally.
Right. And he had been up for over 24 hours.
That's right.
And he had had a previous relationship with the police officer. The police officer had been the enforcement officer at his school. So he had known him.
And trusted him.
Known him and trusted him for years.
That's right.
And I don't remember the exact wording, but at a certain point, he basically said, just what do you need me to tell you?
So you remember correctly.
Yeah.
That's right. So the governor had its investigator go through this file and re-interview people. And interestingly, it wasn't reported the last time I spoke, but the governor's investigator tried to speak with the chief of police, Sellers, and he refused to talk to her. 5 days before Dateline aired the February 14th story about Robert Davis's confession, Chief Sellers went on camera, said that he looked at the video interrogation, and he concluded that it was unreliable because it was not properly done. And the governor had already granted Robert a conditional pardon, and now Robert is seeking an absolute pardon.
So what's a conditional pardon?
Conditional pardon is really being out on parole. You have assigned to you a parole officer, and fortunately, by the pardon itself, you've been able to reduce the sentence that you were originally given on condition that you maintain your the rules and prescribed by your parole officer. And that's where Robert stands right now.
So if anybody is interested in this case, I encourage you to go to SeavillePodcast.com and look up Straight Talk, Andrea's show from, was it March?
March.
Yeah, in March that they were here, when you were here with Robert, and he talked about the ordeal. It's really affecting to hear his story. How many years was he behind bars?
Just under 13.
So under 13. So he was an 18-year-old kid. Now he's in his early 30s.
That's right.
Out for the first time. Where is he living now?
He has an apartment that his parole officers found for him. And he's been working, and he's saving money. Some money was donated for him. He hopes to get a really decent apartment. His apartment now is 400 square feet. So it's a decent place, but he wants to improve his life.
And if you can't talk about this, just tell me, but do you think that Robert has got a civil case against the state, or the circumstances just won't allow that?
We always have that in the back of our minds. But the first steps first. He would not be eligible to bring a lawsuit unless the governor gave him an absolute pardon. There's a state statute that allows people who are wrongfully convicted and spent time in prison to receive state money. So those are factors that we'll take them one at a time.
Okay, so those are down the line. So do you know under what further conditions the governor might need to grant him a full pardon?
Well, the governor did not know at the time of his December 21st pardon that the chief of police, who heretofore refused to talk to the governor's investigator, is now saying that the confession is unreliable.
And
the
governor said this on camera.
He said it on camera. People can go to Dateline's website and find the story. And that was part of the reason the governor only made the pardon conditional, was because there was a question about his confession. Now we know there's no longer a confession. It is unreliable.
Again, fascinating story, and there's more to come. I encourage people to pay attention to this. We only have a few minutes left, but I also want to talk about another high-profile, in this case, international case that you've been involved with locally, and that's the case of Jens Sehring.
I hardly even followed the case, double murder of Elizabeth Haysom's parents down in Bedford County in the 80s. Sehring ultimately was convicted. I first got involved about 4 years ago when Tim Kaine consented to him being transferred under international treaty to which the United States was a signatory, send him back to Germany. And then McDonnell came in office.
Governor McDonnell came in
3 days after the consent was sent to Attorney General Holder.
Right.
McDonnell rescinded it. I brought a lawsuit, didn't even know Jens Sehring until then. And we lost the lawsuit in circuit court, and then the Supreme Court didn't accept it.
How did you get involved at that point?
It was the kind of political case that a lot of lawyers don't want to touch because, you sue a Republican governor, you may lose Republican clients.
Right.
But none of that has mattered to me. And
so, you've made your career of kind of poking at the hornet's nest.
I have. I don't know how many clients I may have lost by bringing these controversial cases, but it's been a rewarding career. So I got to know Jens and would now like to see him sent back to Germany.
You'd like to see him sent back to Germany. Do you have an opinion on his involvement in this homicide?
Well, here's what I'll tell people to do.
Yeah,
a German production company filmed a movie called The Promise. You can see the trailer of it. It'll be It'll be internationally aired at the Munich Film Festival. They take virtually no documentaries, but they've accepted this this story. The BBC bought the rights to it, and The Promise will be aired on BBC in a 3 or 4 part series. In Virginia, they're looking...
And it's about this case.
And it's about this case, and you can't help but believe that Jens Søring is innocent when you hear the lead investigator of the case on camera saying that he doesn't think Jens is guilty. Experts on camera saying that the little physical evidence at the scene does not support a finding that it was Jens Søring. So new evidence has come to light. It's a compelling case. And the international intrigue is that a German citizen wants to go and finish his prison sentence in his homeland. Yeah. That's what the treaty is about. That's what the preamble says. We have American prisoners in foreign lands who want to come home to America. And it is bad policy not to allow Jens Søring, and for that matter, Elizabeth Haysom is also not an American citizen. She's a Canadian citizen, and she could be sent back to Canada.
You know, I actually didn't know that.
It's another sad story of America, who says we're willing to sign off on these treaties, but we're not going to abide by them. And we've seen it too many times in our long history. And that's where it stands now, is whether there will be some international pressure, whether there will be pressure from the state to do what I think is right, and that is to send him back to Germany and back to the culture from which he came.
So the film is The Promise. You can go on the internet now and look for that and get a trailer. And with any luck at all, the film will either air here in the States or maybe even come to Virginia sometime before the end of this year. We'll keep an eye out for that. So, Steve, I promise this. We only got a minute or two left. I promise this at the top of the hour, and we got so involved talking about some of these cases that I didn't mean to save this for the last minute. But what is your advice to people who find themselves on the wrong end of the law for whatever reason, find themselves arrested, find themselves in court or before a judge? What do you tell folks?
Whether you're innocent or guilty, you should always ask for a lawyer.
Now, doesn't asking for a lawyer automatically mean that you're guilty? That's what they say on the TV shows.
Right. The fact that you ask for a lawyer would not be admissible at trial, and so... but it protects you. The questioning has to stop under constitutional standards. And whether you get a lawyer down the road, whether you pay for one, whether you're appointed one, it doesn't matter. It will stop the police interview, questioning, interrogation of you until you can talk to somebody and get the proper advice. And so parents need to teach that. Civics classes ought to have lawyers come in and advise students, don't talk to police if you think that you're going to be the target of the investigation, whether you're innocent or guilty. Now, you know, if you see an accident, a car accident, and a police come over to you and say, did you see that? That's a different story. Sure. Than doing your civic duty. But if there's any possibility whatsoever, and you have to err on the side of thinking, I had nothing to do with it, I wasn't there, but I heard on Sean McCord's show that I should not talk, that there'll be plenty of time later. People don't realize that you can always talk to the police later. They love to have people charged with crime talk to them, and some lawyers will want them to. So just don't talk to the police. Tell your children don't talk to police until they've talked to you, the parents, or the
you're just exercising your simple constitutional rights.
Exactly right.
Right, that are given to us as citizens of this country. Steve, thank you so much for coming by. We could go on, but we can't because the hour is over. You've been listening to The Wake Up Call on 94.7 WPVC. This is Sean McCord with my guest, Steve Rosenfield. This has been great. Let's have you back on again sometime.
Thanks, John. I appreciate that.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.